Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. On November 12, we were pleased to host Oxfam International's Executive Director, Winnie Byanyima. She spoke on the importance of addressing rising global inequality.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for coming along to this event today. My name is Stephen Howes, and I'm the Director of the Development Policy Centre here at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the ANU. We're very happy to welcome you. We'd like to begin by acknowledging and celebrating the first Australians on whose lands we meet, and by paying our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. It's great to see a good turnout today, especially because it is the end of term. We're, apart from those poor students who are still doing exams, the rest of us are on vacation. But I guess it's no surprise that such an important topic and a distinguished speaker has drawn you all to this event. So, as you all know, we've got the G20 coming up this weekend in Brisbane, and you know, one of the big topics that is or should be on the G20 agenda is inequality. And so it's very timely that we're going to have a talk today on the subject of inequality and economic development. And we're delighted to welcome Winnie Byanyima, who's the Oxfam International Executive Director. So it's also welcome to you, Helen, who's the head of Oxfam Australia. We're very happy to work closely with Oxfam on various projects. And, of course, Oxfam is a leading civil society voice, not only in Australia, but all around the world. And I guess their spearhead is Winnie. She's a distinguished, has a distinguished history as a grassroots activist, human rights advocate, senior international public servant, and now the head of Oxfam International. And her topic for today is the rise of inequality and the new economic development consensus. She's going to be speaking for about half an hour, and then we'll have lots of time for Q&A. So please join with me in welcoming Winnie Byanyima.
Thank you for your kind introduction. I would like to begin by acknowledging the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and pay my respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. I arrived here a few days ago and I've been so privileged to learn about the First Nation people of Australia. Just now, I've been to your parliament building and I was able to see the tent embassy, and also yesterday to participate in a program, Straight Talk, an Oxfam program, where women, Indigenous women, meet Australian political leaders. It's a lot of learning for me, and I'm delighted to be here in your country. I also want to say how honored I am to be hosted by the ANU, Crawford School of Public Policy. We admire the work you do, particularly on ODA policy, because we do need the academic vigor that you bring that helps us to underpin the importance of aid for development. Many of you know Oxfam and the work that we do, and I don't think that my colleague, Helen Zocchi, the chief executive of Oxfam Australia, needs an introduction here. I'm honored to be here with her. Oxfam Australia is part of a global Oxfam Confederation. We are 17 organizations that work together in over 90 countries to overcome poverty, inequality, and injustice. We work with partners in these countries we are in, and we work with more than 50,000 volunteers. I have the good fortune to be their global representative. I grew up in a little town in southern Uganda. My family was not wealthy. They were school teachers, my parents. We didn't have electricity in our house. There was no water in the house, running water in the house. We fetched water from the river. We fetched firewood to cook. We read under the light of a kerosene lamp. But in my village, I was considered the well-off one because my parents were teachers. I saw other children I went to school with who didn't have shoes on their feet. I had one pair of shoes, and I felt very privileged. I couldn't understand why I could be with shoes and my girlfriends didn't have shoes. Later on, when I was 11, 12, I couldn't understand why I could stay in school and my best friends, who were even smarter than me in class, dropped out because their parents couldn't pay the fees. I never understood why people were unequal. I still don't, but I hated that kind of inequality. So this year, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Oxfam unveiled a shocking statistic. We said, from our report, a very accurate report, that just 85 rich individuals, the richest people on earth, had more wealth than the poorest half of the world's population, 3.5 billion people. 85 people who can fit on a bus had more wealth than the bottom half of the global population, 3.5 billion people. Since then, we've done more research, and our research has revealed that these 85 richest people in the world saw their collective wealth increase by $668 million per day this year, per day. Almost $500,000 every minute to each one of these 85 individuals. I mean, you have to wonder what they do to earn like that. Well, today, almost half the world's wealth is owned by just 1% of the world's population. In South Africa, economic inequality is greater today than it was at the end of apartheid, almost 20 years ago. Our research has shown that on average, a platinum miner in South Africa would need to work 93 years just to earn the annual bonus of the chief executive of the company. 93 years. In countries like yours, the US and the UK, inequality is increasing sharply. Here in Australia, the richest 1% have more wealth than the poorest 60% combined. And in the US, we know that the wealthiest 1% captured 95% of the post-financial crisis growth, while 90% of people became poorer. So I could go on with these statistics, and I could begin to sound like I just envy rich people. Well, I don't. But I'm going to tell you what is wrong with rising inequality. Four reasons I will advance. But I will also tell you that there are solutions. So I will also talk about the solutions. So what are those four reasons? One, inequality makes fighting poverty harder. And that's why we are in this as Oxfam, because our mission is to fight the injustice of poverty. And we find that inequality makes fighting poverty harder. The evidence is strong that extremes of inequality are threatening to set back the fight against poverty by decades. In recent years, numbers of people living in absolute poverty has declined in some countries dramatically, China, India, even in Africa. But even as the world negotiates a new set of global development goals, we see that inequality is putting the ambitious target to end extreme poverty by 2030 out of reach. Our research shows that in countries like Kenya, Indonesia, and India, millions more people could be lifted out of poverty if income inequality were reduced. Take the case of India. If the country was to stop inequality rising, keep it where it is, India could lift 90 million people out of poverty by 2019, in 4 years' time, 5 years' time. If African countries continue on their current growth trajectories with no change in income inequality levels, then the continent will not end extreme poverty until 2075, 61 years away. So poverty and inequality are linked and must be tackled together. Second reason, inequality is bad for growth, for economic growth. Well, the old consensus was that with more growth, wealth would trickle down and incomes, along with living standards, would eventually even up. We have had this long debate with the mainstream institutions, economic and financial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF. But now, those very same institutions are speaking a different language today. The new research from them, not from us, is that inequality is bad for long-term sustainable economic growth. The IMF released a paper this year that said, and I quote, "It would be a mistake to focus on growth and let inequality take care of itself, not only because inequality may be ethically undesirable, but also because the resulting growth may be low and unsustainable." That's the IMF. So these same ideas are echoed by the World Economic Forum, the OECD, regional banks like the Asian Development Bank and of course, the World Bank. So there's no debate anymore that inequality slows economic growth. But Oxfam, we are concerned that today the G20 leaders are going to be here, are arriving, but on their agenda they're talking about lifting growth and are not talking about lifting inclusive growth, are not talking about the role that inequality plays in slowing growth. And that's why I'm here, to tell them that Oxfam's evidence is that if you want growth, you must tackle inequality. So inequality is bad for growth, and that's now coming from the mainstream economic institutions, so that debate is closed. The trickle-down theory is a closed debate. The third reason is that inequality is bad for social stability. That we know too. Today, we are seeing some of the results of inequality and its impact on social cohesion. A case in point is Latin America, which is the most unequal region in the world. Latin America has 41 of the world's most dangerous cities, and it saw 1 million murders take place between 2000 and 2010. You can also see that where you're having a rise in religious and nationalist extremism in some parts of the world, such as Nigeria in Africa, that is happening in parts of the country that are the most unequal, parts of the country that have been economically excluded, where young people have no hope for education or for employment. So there's a strong correlation between inequality and social stability. Fourth, inequality undermines democracy. We call it political capture. When wealth, extreme wealth, and politics come together and couple, you get a situation where the rules, the policies, the budgets are skewed in favor of the rich. The decision-making process is hijacked. There's political capture of democracy. And you find that the best education, the best health, the best jobs are for the rich, and poorer people have less and less a say on the budgets, on the policies of their countries. In developed and developing countries alike, you will find that the lowest tax rates, the best health, the best education, the opportunities to influence are for the rich, and they pass them on to their children. So it becomes an intergenerational cycle of exclusion, political, economic exclusion. So when the wealthiest use their financial power and influence to bend the laws and the policy choices in favor of themselves, then really the democracy has been hijacked. I want also to add here the dimension of women and women's inequality, because it is when systems don't work for everybody that you also see women fall more and more behind men. Women relegated to the worst paid and most insecure jobs, so you may see growth, but growth bringing jobs that aren't good jobs, that don't pay women as much as men, that don't give security to women, and so on. At the current rate that the gender wage gaps, the gender wage gap globally would take 75 years to close if nothing is done to bridge the gap between men and women. Without a concerted effort to tackle inequality, privilege and disadvantage will continue down the generations. Oxfam's working hard to support citizens and local communities to raise their voices and to turn such unjust situations around. So, four reasons I've given why inequality is bad. Does it have to stay like that? Not really. And what's exciting is that there's now a new consensus for tackling inequality. Since we released our report in Davos in January, we're seeing this consensus growing stronger and stronger. The World Economic Forum, the World Bank, the OECD, the IMF, regional banks I've mentioned, are all calling for action on inequality. In May this year, the governor of the Bank of England said that extreme economic behavior is starting to break down the social contract within nations. President Barack Obama described inequality as the defining issue of our time and called for a major conference on inequality. Even the Pope said that social inequality was the root of all evil. So it's also condemned by God. Even I am told Rupert Murdoch has recently expressed some concerns about rising inequality. What more could you want? The consensus is there. So everyone agrees that there is a problem. And Oxfam says that there are solutions. Such a consensus should lead to solutions. We describe ourselves as practical visionaries, and we want to see this consensus lead to solutions. Inequality is not inevitable. It is a result of policy choices, and different choices can reverse it. So here at the G80, I'm here with a big team from Oxfam. We are here because the G20 accounts for 85% of global GDP. It's also the home of more than half of the world's poorest people. So we want the G20 to take heed of the warnings of all these institutions that have said that inequality is derailing the fight against poverty and threatening growth. Solutions. I'm going to talk about four ways to turn the tide on inequality. We should fix the global tax system. It's leaking. We need to support investment in essential public services. These are the great levelers, essential public services. Third, we need to bridge the gap between men and women. And fourth, we need to reclaim democracy. Global tax rules. Multinational companies have been using their power for a long time to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. Estimates are that $100 billion is lost to developing countries each year through tax avoidance and tax dodging. $100 billion. The current network of secrecy and low tax rates facilitates the illicit flows of large amounts of capital from the poorest nations. We have estimated, Oxfam has estimated, that wealthy individuals, not the companies yet, just the individuals, hide $18.5 trillion in tax havens. $18.5 trillion. And it's interesting that the new European president is facing actually a scandal of tax havens in his country, Luxembourg. So to put this into perspective, $18.5 trillion, the US GDP, the richest country on earth, is just under $16 trillion. So you're talking of more money than you have in the whole American economy. So what do these tax dodging practices really mean for the poorest people? Let's take Sierra Leone, one of the nations where the Ebola epidemic is raging. In Sierra Leone, tax incentives for just six companies were equivalent to 59% of the country's entire budget in 2012. Think about that. 60% of the budget, just the tax incentives for six companies. And that amount of money was also more than eight times the country spent on health. Eight times what the country spent on health, seven times what it's spending on education. So underinvestment in public health systems is the reason why Ebola got so out of hand. Ebola has hit my country, Uganda, where I come from, four times. Each time, my country has been able to contain it. It didn't become an epidemic like this. Because it's a poor country, but there were little more resources in the health system, little more infrastructure. So imagine six companies, if they paid a little more taxes, and if that money went into the health system, Sierra Leone wouldn't be where it is today. So what must the G20 do on this issue? Well, the G20, when the financial crisis hit, commissioned the OECD to do some work on a project they call base erosion and profit shifting, which is about reforming the tax system, global tax system, so as to raise more resources. The current OECD-led process, that process I've mentioned on tax reform, is a good start. But we need to see a global discussion on tax avoidance that really brings in all the developing countries as equal partners to the table. Because as I've said before, they lose so much and need to be part of that discussion to plug the leaking system of the global tax system. We need to increase transparency. Companies should make the tax they pay in every country public. Currently, they hide behind subsidiaries. And governments should commit to reveal who owns what assets and to tackle tax evasion. So there's a lot of work to be done. Good work has started with the OECD, but we want to broaden this and to look at the entire system, not to try to fix little parts of it. So a lot can be done within countries and globally to get global companies to pay their fair share. Second, investing in essential services. As I've said, accessible public services, quality services, particularly healthcare and education, are the great equalizers. I'm here in front of you because I got a quality public education and public health. where would you have found a Ugandan girl? You wouldn't have seen me because the cost of education would not have been affordable for most people in our countries. But again, you see that in many, many developing countries, healthcare is not free anymore. Education, especially at the higher levels, is not free at all. So rolling out free healthcare, free education is a great equalizer. It's a virtual income for poor people. Every year, 100 million people are driven into poverty because they are forced to pay for health care. Did you know that? At least 1 million women die in childbirth between 2009 and 2014 due to a lack of basic health services. In my country, the figure is 18 women die every single day because they can't access maternal health care. 18 women by the end of today will have lost their lives because they cannot access a clinic to have a safe baby, to have a baby safely. So, I could give you more examples, but free health, free education would level the ground for many. Third, bridge the gap between men and women. As I've said, people must pay, as I have said, men and women, equality between men and women can be advanced if the political process, if democracies are in the hands of men and women. Unfortunately, they are not. Women continue to effectively subsidize economies, averaging up to 5 hours more unpaid work than men per day globally. This figure is huge when you talk about the low-income agrarian economies where much of life is lived at a subsistence level and women are the backbone of the family and the productive economy. So the monetary value of women's unpaid care work is estimated at anything between 10 to 50% of countries' GDP. When women earn more and when they spend more, it benefits their children and their local communities. This data is strong and is compelling. In fact, when women earn more, they spend more on their families, and actually there's also a correlation with growth. The Australian Prime Minister has proposed a target to lift women's workplace participation by 25%. This is welcome. Oxfam welcomes this. But we want to see more than this. A target to help close the workforce participation gap between women and men is not enough. We need to see also the wage gap closing. You don't want to see more women in the workplace. You need to see them paid fairly and earning equally with men for the same kind of work. So we would like to see a target to end the gender pay gap as well, not just the gender employment gap. We also want to see that jobs that men and women get are secure, that the wages are living wages, and that workers have a right to organize and to negotiate. One of the key reasons that women still do not enjoy full equality with men is power. Who has it and who does not? Who takes decisions? And until women also have a share of political power that's equal to men's, it will not be possible to close the gaps between men and women economically. My fourth point, reclaiming democracy. We need to confront inequality by backing people's claims for their rights, by supporting people to hold their leaders accountable. We need to change the rules, because the rules have been skewed in favor of a few rich people, rich companies. We need to put young people also at the heart of political processes, to give them a voice in decision making. I'm very inspired by what has recently happened on my continent, Africa. Recently in the small country of Burkina Faso, young people fed up of political exclusion and economic exclusion, were watching a parliament about to change a constitution to allow a leader who's been in power like 26, 27 years to stay in power for another term, and said no. They stood up, they protested, and the leader fled. It was a peaceful protest, although they burnt down the parliament building. They didn't kill anyone. They just burnt down a building. It would be reconstructed. But they took to the streets and they reclaimed. They made their voices heard, and they changed a bad they stopped a bad decision from being made. That's really my last point to you. Young people, you are here because you're learning, you're acquiring knowledge, and you're citizens of your countries. You should be part of your democracies. You should make your voices heard. I'm not asking you to go on the street to burn the parliament, but I'm asking you to be active citizens, to participate, to insist that democracy belongs, its power belonging to people, and importantly, to young people. All of us can make a contribution to reclaim democracies. It begins there. We have rising inequality because global companies have become so big and have escaped the reach of governments. They have escaped the control of people through the democracy. They have hijacked democracies. We must reclaim democracy. So, if the growth plans to be announced in Brisbane by the G20 are to be sustainable and are to have a long-term impact and to benefit everybody, they must recognize the threats posed by extreme and growing inequality. The growth, the 2% growth that's going to be probably announced as a target by the G20 must be equitable. Oxfam says it will not happen unless it is targeted as inclusive growth, equitable growth. G20 nations are home to more than half of the world's poorest people. They have a share of 85% of the global economy. Those leaders that are going to be in Brisbane have it in their hands to achieve growth that is inclusive and that will lift everybody up. Thank you very much.
Anna, please stay. You stay here. Thank you very much, Winnie. I think your short time given us a comprehensive diagnosis and set of recommendations. So I'd like to invite some questions, comments from the floor. And if you could just perhaps state your name and affiliation. Yeah, sure.
Hi, I'm Shakira Bowman from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. If you could suggest one concrete thing that G20 leaders could commit to, I mean, other than the broad equal growth, what one action would you like to see them take to lead them towards that outcome?
Well, could I take two or three at once?
Yeah, why don't we take a few more questions? I'm just trying to turn that screen off. Yeah, please.
Yes, Matt Collis from the University of Melbourne. You talked about, similar from just the previous question, reducing inequality also requires, as well as healthcare being an education, the creation of a lot of jobs. And in developing countries, inclusive growth and also sustainable growth, which industries are these jobs for a large amount of people that are currently disenfranchised going to come from?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Where are the jobs going to come from? I think you said, you need to get jobs to combat inequality.
Yeah.
Where will the jobs come from? Mm. And sorry, I missed one question in the front. Yeah,
please. I'm Dana Rawls with the Crawford School here. You mentioned a lot of the horror stories that are out, and I'm wondering are there any stories or any countries that have actually done things to improve inequality that you kind of consider to be your benchmarks?
Mm-hmm. Should I start?
Yeah, clearly your favorite there.
One outcome that could come. If the G20 leaders could make a commitment on global tax reform, and particularly on the issue of increasing transparency of tax flows, perhaps also closing tax havens, my list becomes bigger and bigger. But I think that the addressing tax reforms, plugging the loopholes of tax evasion and tax avoidance would be for me a big one if they could commit there. And the transparency bit, getting the transparency and the sharing of information across countries is the bigger piece in that for me. Then jobs. Where are the jobs to come from? It depends on where you are. If I take, say, the African countries, the African economies, right now there's a natural resource boom in Africa. Most of those countries are now, first of all, it's like the new frontier for oil and gas. It's got minerals, it's got forests and so on. But extractive industries don't create jobs. The jobs have to come from plowing the resources from extractives into the sectors where people are and where there's a comparative advantage for them to gain on the in global trade, and that's agriculture. If more could be put in transforming agriculture, African agriculture, there are many, many jobs there for people. And there's also tourism. Tourism is an industry that has many other industries connected to it, and that creates a lot of jobs for people. So that's one region. But you find that others, the opportunity is in knowledge, in investing more in people's capabilities to have jobs that are the result of digital technology, for example. So it will vary from country to country, but there is a place for each country to contribute in trade. It's only when you have rules that don't allow people to have a voice in the shaping of their policies that you find that the policies are skewed in favor of taking out money by a few, or the growth being captured by a few, and the majority staying in poverty and without opportunity. So it would depend. A little country like Rwanda, it doesn't have mineral resources, but currently is growing at 13%. It is one of the fastest growing countries in Africa. And and its growth is quite inclusive, because that little country has been able to wipe out malaria. The neighboring country, Uganda, which is 2-3 times richer, still has malaria-killing babies and adults. So it's how the resources that it makes are then invested back in public services. So jobs, yes, jobs come from those sectors that will have a comparative advantage, that employ many people, but that also create a niche for that country in a global market. And jobs also come from investing in people's capabilities to be able to be productive. Tackling inequality, good example. I'll give you two comparisons, a good and bad example, to show what is possible. Take a country like Nigeria. Nigeria recently announced itself as having recalculated its economy and declared itself middle income. Indeed, it is. It said the calculation was not right. They are a rich country, and they are. But still, Nigeria, 40% of the people are below the poverty line. They don't enjoy health services. Their access to education, very low. You take a country like Bangladesh, its income per capita is less than half of the recalculated one for Nigeria. But that country, all the children go to school. Public health is accessible, almost double the rate in Nigeria. And you say, how did this happen? It's the choices that Bangladesh makes. Its wealth is being plowed back to people and lifting more people out of poverty than the huge wealth from oil and gas of Nigeria. So it's the public policies. It's the public policies that are channeling the wealth back to people and lifting people out of poverty. So you can see, you can compare the social indicators with economic growth, and that can tell you the story of how the democracy is working for that country.
Okay, great. Let's take so quite a few questions earlier. Let's start here.
Hi, thank you. My name is JJ. As you all know, a lot of companies and individuals who are in the top 1% probably don't like the idea of having their money being reduced to looking to the system. So I guess one incentive for them is probably saying that's tax deductible, which means the government would win, they would win, because then they would receive the money back. Is it possible perhaps a solution would be looking into some sort of like a pot of money that, you know, let's say in Uganda, for instance, and Microsoft's there, and you know, Apple's there, and then you have big oil company there too. So at the same time, could they look into a tax deductible program that could be linked up to the government's health and social welfare projects, I guess, that would also benefit them in the long run as well? Because when you're talking with companies, they want to see, well, what's the benefit for me in the end?
Okay.
Is there something similar like this being developed, or would you think this kind of idea might be viable? Or
okay.
Okay. We've got the idea. Yeah, there are a few more. Yeah, please. Lower than the blue. Yeah, first of all, this.
My name is Dorothy Broom. I'm from the National Center for Epidemiology and Population Health here. And I wanted to hear your comments.
Can you just speak up a bit? Well, we do have a microphone next to you.
I'd appreciate your comments on the implications for the project of reducing inequality of trade agreements such as the TPP currently being negotiated, and particularly the concerning aspect of the inclusion of investor-state dispute resolution provisions in those agreements, which, as I understand it, have potential to undermine democratic and policy settings that will advance greater equality.
Okay, maybe just pass the microphone this way. Sorry, down to the gentleman in blue.
My name is Peter Lin. Just a question. I'm not sure whether Oxfam or any other organizations have done a study on the possible impact of corruption linking with inequality, and also any work being done in terms of improving the justice and government situation in those countries. Justice and government situation.
Corruption and inequality.
Okay.
First, I think I understood you to mean that is there a win-win for rich companies and citizens in this in taxation? Can you create a win-win? Well, first, I have to say that this is an issue of fair share. It can't be right that you have poor people, ordinary people, paying proportionately higher taxes than rich companies. So it's first of all a matter of justice, of tax justice. We've seen regressive taxation come in and become the norm. We are saying that's wrong. If you see in many developing countries, the main source of taxation is increasingly VAT. That's a regressive tax. And we know that when poor people are spending on the basics of life like food and even health and little things for their children, and transportation, and that is taxed more heavily than the luxury goods of rich people. That's not just. So there's an issue of justice, and I don't see that as a win-win situation. It's a question of justice. But also, if you want to look at it as what do the rich gain, there's so much they gain. And increasingly, we're seeing wealthy people speaking out in favor of fair taxation. Warren Buffett in the United States. I think there's a whole now movement around, what do they call it? There's a name for 50. Yeah, he said, look, I'm paying less tax than my secretary, relatively. And there's a whole movement of wealthy people, chief executives, philanthropists saying we should pay fair share of taxation. We've been talking with George Soros, and I hope to be writing a blog with him. George Soros with Oxfam. And his point is that he calls it market fundamentalism. He's opposed to market fundamentalism, and he agrees with us on this issue of taxation. So there is a movement also including wealthy people and companies that see that it's not even good for business. It's not good for business that they don't pay their fair share and bring money back into the system to give people opportunity, because with opportunity, then they can also buy more from them. There is something there about the illogic of capturing the growth and leaving the majority without anything. It's self-defeating. Then on the question of, and this, by the way, this issue became so political during the financial crisis and the economic recession that followed, when many countries put in austerity measures but said the banks were too big to fail and gave them bailouts. It became so clear that, I mean, whose democracy is this? Is one law for the rich and one for the poor? You tighten your belt if you're poor and you're left scot-free when you're rich? It's becoming clearer and clearer, and there's a movement of people against tax injustice. So I guess there's a win-win in that if you regulate well, then the rich can continue earning, but it's not a win-win if there's tax injustice. Investor-state dispute resolutions. I don't know much about the trade area, but Oxfam works on fair trade issues and on trade for development issues. But on investor-state dispute resolutions, we've been doing some work in this area. We've been following a case such as that of El Salvador, where you're seeing companies really shamelessly suing governments for stopping them from scooping super profits from their economies. This challenge by global companies to national governments really trying to take away the sovereignty of people is frightening. And that's why we are building a movement. We are saying that this really is an issue of the capture of democracy. If we don't tackle it as a political issue where global companies have run out of control and are usurping even the power of governments, we are not going to get a handle on this. Taxation isn't just a technical issue, a financial issue. It's a question of the usurpation of democracies. So we need to work on it as a political issue. And we're watching this, and for us, we are into movement building. We think the challenge will come from tackling this as a political issue. corruption and inequality clearly closely related. I could have given you some statistics about illicit financial flows and what that is doing to the economies of the developing countries. I think we have a figure of several trillions of dollars that are lost to developing countries, not just from tax evasion and tax avoidance, but from all other ways, corrupt ways, that resources are extracted from these countries. Huge amounts, several times over the aid that goes to these countries. So that's something that some organizations are doing research on, and we are also following closely on. It's a strong, when there's no transparency in how resources are collected and then invested, of course you get corruption. But these relationships are studied by many organizations, and we follow that too.
Okay, I think we've got time just for one last round of questions. Yeah.
Thanks, Bea. Sophie McKinnon, also from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I completely agree with your point that there's a need to look at the balance between the taxation for multinational companies between whether it's distributed to the host country or it goes back to the source country.
Mm.
And it could essentially be a zero-sum game whereby the multinational company isn't paying any more tax. It's just that that balance is shifted more towards the host country. And I wonder if there you could have some strong allies in the multinational companies themselves who would see the benefit in a larger proportion of their money going to the host country, which in the long term could improve their business operations in that country, and whether they could be potentially a good ally then to convince probably the Western governments of the benefits of such reform.
Mm-hmm. Interesting question.
Just hang on. This is going to be our last chance, I'm afraid. Yeah, two final questions.
Sue Harrison from the ANU. I just wanted to ask, what prospects do you think civil society has for influence at the G20? What's been your experience this year? What are you hoping for in Brisbane? What are the prospects for Turkey?
Mm.
And then there was one over here. Yeah, do you want to just speak?
Yeah, so I noticed today that you haven't talked at all about the impact of climate change on exacerbating inequality, such as the disappearance of crop varieties, which I know is hurting farmers in developing countries. Is climate change an aspect of Oxfam's G20 agenda, and what actions do you think need to be taken with regards to environmental issues and inequality?
Okay.
Please.
Okay, you know, on taxation and getting the benefits to come to host country or source country, we are here because we are able now to discuss this issue of global tax reform because of what happened in the north. The financial crisis, the economic recession made the countries, the developed countries, look closely at where will resources come from to put in our social services, in our system. Because it was a crisis for the northern countries. So the discussion on tax reform became more urgent. The northern economies realized that they were not getting what they should get from the companies in their own, registered in their own countries. But the issue had been one that developing countries had been talking about for a long time, about their inability to collect their fair share as source countries. So now I see an opportunity for a consensus on this. Both the source countries and the host countries need to capture the fair share of taxation from these companies that operate in developing countries and remit their profits in their host countries. So there's an opportunity for having a global discussion on this. And I think it's not a question of who benefits more or less. It's really a question of where is your operation? Where is your operation? Where are you earning from? You must pay there. And then where you are also banking, you earn from your the interest on what you bank. And there too, there's some taxation. So it's really a case of, it's a win-win. When you have transparency of the resource flows, then you can have a fair share where operations are, where production is, and a share where the profits are repatriated. That's how I would see it. And that's why Oxfam is calling for a wider discussion. We support the OECD BEPS project, but we would like to see a wider discussion involving developing countries so that there is a benefit for both. On the question of G20 and civil society prospects for influence, we're here because the G20 is a new platform and an important platform. We are seeing paralysis in the multilateral system. The United Nations, the international financial institutions, at that level of global governance, we are seeing paralysis. And the paralysis is because these institutions are post-Second World War institutions, reflecting the power balance at that time. But power has shifted. It has shifted from the northern institutions that created, that had the power at the time, to the east, to the south, and we're seeing these countries that are emerging challenging and the United Nations and the IFIs. So you get now new arrangements. You get the G20, you get the BRICS, you get regional groupings. These are now important centers of power that matter for us and we want to influence. Of course, the G20 doesn't have really strong formal structures through which it can enforce decisions. It's still a gentleman's club, but it's influential. It's influential, and we're here because we know that this is the trend. This is where power is shifting. These new institutions are going to become more and more important, while the older ones, if they don't reform, will become less and less relevant and influential. So that might not answer your question fully, but we see the G20 and the new formations as important and as where power is shifting to. That's why we are here as Oxfam. Inequality, climate change. I didn't speak about climate change because I wanted to focus on one area, but you're quite right. Oxfam sees two big global challenges today, rising inequality and the challenge of climate change. And they are not different. They are strongly connected. You're quite right to say that climate change is impacting poor people more than richer people in countries and between countries. We're seeing that. We're seeing that the impacts are real for the very poor, vulnerable states, that richer countries can cushion themselves from the impacts of climate change, while poorer ones can't. That women are suffering more impacts sometimes than men because of the different roles they play and the different access they have to resources, to information, to technology, and so on. So climate change is worsening inequalities between countries, within countries, between men and women. And we see that we've been pushing hard that the G20 has it on the agenda. We're happy to learn. I've just come back from a meeting with Helen, with your secretary in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he confirmed to us that, yes, climate change will be discussed, but at the G20. We've been pushing for that, and we're happy at that. Two things we would like to come out of this meeting. One is more commitments, to more pledges to climate financing, the Global Climate Fund. We need more resources there and more resources for adaptation. That is where the developing countries need support and should get support, because their contribution to climate change is so much less, but they are absorbing the worst impacts. So resources for adaptation, much needed. More resources have come in for mitigation, less for adaptation. We want to see more resources for adaptation. Secondly, of course, emission targets, more ambitious emission targets from governments. So this is an important moment for G20 to step up as we prepare for the next round of negotiations in Lima. So anything they can say towards emission targets, climate financing, we will be very happy.
All right. Well, we are out of time, I'm afraid. So, Winnie, thank you very much for all the insights. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.